Welcome back to another episode of the Booked Out Blank podcast. We have a very special guest. This is the first guest introduced by another guest, Nina Collins. We have the wonderful Jacqueline Woods, and she's an author. An author has written many books. These books have won many awards, and she's sitting here with us. How are you doing? Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm good. I'm glad to be talking to two brilliant brothers. So I'm excited. I'm always excited to talk about poetry and literature in general. So I'm good today. Right now, I am good, which is a great thing to be in a pandemic.
Yeah, no, very grateful for that. So what book did you choose for this conversation? When was the first time you read it? Why is it, you know, so meaningful to you?
So the book I chose for this conversation is Hurdy Gurdy by Tim Siebels. And I feel like one of the reasons I chose this book is it's such a through line in so much of my writing. And the reason that is because I first got introduced to Tim Siebels in 1991, when I was a fellow at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. And for those of you who don't know, the Fine Arts Work Center is a residency where 20 writers and visual artists are chosen, and you move to Provincetown for 7 months from October through May. And the hope was that it would create a community that would live in Provincetown, right? That they would lure artists there through this residency, and people would say, oh, you know, this is cool, I'm going to stay. And the year that I was a fellow, it was kind of a fluke year, because if for those who don't know, Cape Cod is very, very white. And the residency had hosted maybe two people of the global majority at one time, but not ever more than that. And people had, I guess by some people had dropped out, somehow it ended up being five of us out of this 20 people. And one of those people was Tim Siebels, who I had never heard of. We were all young in our writing at that time, in our writing careers. But one thing about poetry was I always felt like it was a language I wasn't meant to understand. And a lot of the poets I had read as a younger person seemed to be pretentious and seemed to be overly white. So we would have to do readings every so often. And Tim got up and started reading, and I was like, oh, shoot, I understand what he's saying. I understand what he's talking about. Like, I can understand poetry. And it was this introduction that felt like a party I was suddenly invited to. And so when he published Hurdy Gurdy, which was in 1992, I was still in Provincetown. And he did a reading, and I just fell in love with this book. And I've bought this book for everybody, you know, 11-year-old boys, 50-year-old women, teachers, a cop, like anyone, because I'm like, here is a dialogue we can have. And I love it.
Wow. That's such a great point about poetry being kind of held over kids' heads as like this, you know, very deep esoteric thing. And then as soon as you read the right poet, right, it changes the entire game. Because like, I was, you know, starting this book of poetry. I actually don't know the last book of poems that I've read, but I was reading it like I was reading news. And I was like, this is not right. You got to slow down. You got to like pause. Because as soon as, and you know, the poem I thought of was To the Movies. It has this line, we're talking about the sweet brown rice at the bottoms of empty cokes. And I was like, wow, that's not esoteric at all. He's literally just describing a thing that I'd always glanced at, but right, like it's just so rich, just the detail there.
And then you never unsee it, right? That's the thing about, you're changed forever, because you're never going to see that ice at the bottom of a Coke the same way again.
Yeah. For me, that line was in Shape, where he says, when the door marked men opens, I am kissing the silver curl rising from the fountain. And I like read it and then was like, hold up. And then I like read it again. And I was like, oh shit, he's talking about drinking water. I was like, what? Because at first I was like, oh my God, that was the most poetic way that he could have put that. But then I thought about it. I was like, that's literally what you're doing. And that's why it makes so much sense. That's why it was so seamless for like understanding that image, was because that's literally what you're doing. You like, you know, go on.
Exactly. Go on
and kiss the silver curl. And I was like, wow, this guy is really doing something here.
He is really bringing the language. So can I read the poem that I was like, I'm not gonna curse on here, but I was like, oh shoot, you know, he's talking my language. I know this. So it's on page 24 and it's called Meep. And I don't know, maybe this was just my childhood, but I don't know if people remember Roadrunner and Coyote. Yeah. And it was a cartoon and the coyote was always trying to get this Roadrunner and never got him. And so this poem is, and then there was the cereal commercial about Trix cereal, and it was like, silly rabbit, Trix are for kids. And so it was this rabbit that was always trying to get the cereal, and the kids were like, no, basically this is for humans. But it was about, you know, being constantly denied something. And so this poem really spoke to me. I used to root for the rabbit in his sneaky quest for that fruity cereal, raspberry red, lemon yellow, orange. And I hated those big-headed little brats, especially the boy, when he'd say, silly rabbit, Trix are for kids. I always wish he'd smile. Okay, one bowl won't hurt, because it really wouldn't have. I used to console myself believing the silly rabbit swiped a bunch between commercials. And I used to cross my fingers for the coyote too, sometimes running like a maniac, his legs bulging from acne muscle builder. He gets so close, I could feel the Roadrunner's tail feathers tickling his nose. But suddenly, meep, meep, and the road was smoke all the way to the horizon. The coyote seemed so ruined the way he'd knot his brow while his pointed face went slack. I would shake my head and wonder if he ever got to eat anything, ever. And why didn't he just give up on that bird or occasionally go for something slow? So I love that. I mean, that's not the whole poem. I won't read the whole poem to you, but it's just such a great way of, you know, that intersectionality between like childhood and looking back on childhood from this adult perspective and understanding that that's what's happening to us constantly, right? That longing, that something constantly escaping us that we think we desire or need, and the world saying you ain't getting this. So
yeah, we grew up watching Wile E. Coyote like chase after Roadrunner, and I don't know why we've never like laughed so hard. And it's hilarious because it's just a lot of violence, he never gets them. But there's actually like a Seth MacFarlane sketch where Wile E. Coyote finally catches Roadrunner, and then they show his life after the fact, and it's hilarious because, like, you know, he's spending his whole life trying to like get this damn bird. And when he finally does, he realizes that he has like no meaning left. Exactly. So it's like it's messed up. It's kind of sick, but it's like it's so funny. And it's just like a great way of like, you know, adding on to a show that we really appreciated as kids. And Meep, you know, especially given that it's earlier on in the book, definitely registered for me, honestly, because I thought of Kendrick Lamar, Cereal, and Cartoons and Cereal, right? That's like an old Kendrick Lamar song. And it's building on that same legacy that Tim Siebel's was laying down with that poem, right? Mm. Because it's about recognizing this like very intimate cultural space that, you know, Miles and I and our sister enjoyed as kids, and kind of like tying us in with all these other people who had that same exact experience, you know?
Wow, it's so true. Yeah. It's so true how it becomes universal, you know, in this way. And I think that's what good writing does. It really shines a light on a specific to show the universality of it.
Right. So would you say that's part of the through line that you have like used from this book to translate into your own writing?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, I remember writing Brown Girl Dreaming and just whining and whining, like, you know, why am I obsessed with writing this book? No one's ever going to read it. It's, you know, all about my life and who cares about my life? And, you know, people are just like, keep writing. It's going to work out fine. The thing I think I was fearful of was how specific it was. And the thing that did give me strength was poetry because of its specificity. And because in a book like Hurdy-Gurdy, he's talking about race, he's talking about love, he's talking about desire, he's talking about longing and all of these. I know desire and longing are kind of similar, but like sexual desire and, you know, other kind of physical desires as well. And I knew that I had, if I could hit those chords in the narrative, then it would speak to more people than myself. Even though when I'm writing, I'm not thinking about my reader, but I am thinking about what makes this interesting, what makes it interesting to me, because if I'm bored, I know my reader is going to be bored. And poetry, really, every time I got stuck, I would go back to poetry. And that's the same case for everything from Red at the Bone to Another Brooklyn, you know, my adult stuff and my stuff for young people and picture books, like all of it line by line is very specific. And I'm also knowing that I can do stuff with words that's going to make you see the moment differently with a different kind of light on it. I'm trying to think of an example. In Red at the Bone, I started, you know, the first line is, but that afternoon there was an orchestra playing. And that's a very intentional thing of starting a narrative in the middle of the sentence, in the middle of a moment. So you know you're not being dropped down at the beginning of something. You're being dropped right into the center of it. And that's something I learned from poetry, that you can play with time and space that way. And as long as your language is intentional, and something people want to read, then it's going to be digested.
We, you know, Jen and I have been thinking a lot recently about like why memoirs are so popular now, because we're like, what is that saying about readers when they really feel they want a connection with like someone's life, to even know more things about a writer than they might know about like their close friends? And I'm like curious now, because you were saying how this book was harder to write, like, what do you think the difference is between like writing Brown Girl Dreaming and writing some of your other novels? And, you know, you also took a very original take on the form in general by writing it, you know, in poetry, right? And I think that really gives your own story, your own life, room to breathe, literally just on the page, right? There's so much space that's not taken up that you can really focus on the words and your story in a different way. So yeah, I would just love for you to speak a little bit more about that.
Such a great question. You know, in terms of, it is interesting that people want to crack the code of the writer, right? And asking questions in terms of how the story got on the page or the choices we make. And I think we lie a lot and wax poetic about stuff we don't really understand ourselves. And then there is the stuff that we truly understand. Like, I do know that Brown Girl Dreaming was written in verse because it's memory. And that's how memory comes to us. It comes to us in these small moments with all of this white space around it. And that white space is the unknown. And it's like, I can link this memory to that memory to some extent, but there are missing pieces there. And what my job as the writer is to do is to make you feel like this story is going to be okay, even with those missing pieces. And I think that speaks to people's lives, right? There are places where we have serious gaps in memory, or places where we've decided we don't want to remember something. And then our narrative continues. And then the thing about Brown Girl Dreaming was, you know, I rewrote that book so many times. I had to rewrite it to get that narrative arc going from before I was born to the moment when I realized this is why I'm a writer. I had to write it because I had so many characters that had to have a beginning, middle, and end. I had to write it so that the transitions from Ohio to Greenville to New York felt seamless and matter. And even the constant resistance, that was the resistance of the civil rights movement. That was the resistance of me to religion, of the resistance of me to, you know, being a slow reader who wanted to be a writer, and people saying that doesn't really jive. So I think in that book, I was so much in my head and conscious of what I was doing, as opposed to fiction, where I'm thinking, I don't want to know too much. I want to let my subconscious and my unconscious help me tell this story so that I can say, I don't really know where that character came from, but she's working here, or he's working here. And so when I'm writing fiction, usually I have a voice in my head that's a character, and that character's saying something. And when you have and then you have another character you put in the room, and you have everything, right? You have dialogue between the two characters. Then you're going to have conflict because eventually they're not going to agree. And you already have your setting, which is the space that they're having this conversation in. With Brown Girl Dreaming, all of those settings were places I remembered. And something like Red at the Bone, there were places I had to paint. And then there's Another Brooklyn, which is kind of a combination between the two, because Another Brooklyn is poetry. And that's the, you know, that's the white space, that's the intentionality of the language. And then it's nonfiction because all the spaces are true. I wanted to, when I wrote Another Brooklyn, I really wanted to have Bushwick remembered, because people were talking about discovering, quote unquote, Bushwick. And I was like, no, this place was here, you know, unless you're one of the Lenape people, you did not discover this place, right? That's the indigenous tribe that was here long before people came in Columbus, that neighbor, those areas. So, I wanted the Bushwick of the 70s to the 90s to be remembered, because it was changing very quickly. And that neighborhood that I had known as a young person was quickly getting erased. And so that's all nonfiction. And then the fiction is the story of the four girls, four characters that I made up. And so I had to figure out how to draw them with words so that they could feel real. So it was a lot of different parts of my brain working for that book. That was very different than Brown Girl Dreaming and Red at the Bone, yet it made sense, because going from Brown Girl Dreaming, which was a memoir, I couldn't jump directly into fiction. I had to have kind of a segue, and being able to remember Bushwick was that segue. Does that answer your question, Miles?
Yes. Jan and I are just like, we just got chills right now. That answer was, wow, you took us on a whole journey there. You know, I've only lived, you know, a couple decades of life, but I think your story there about Brooklyn and trying to remember the Bushwick of the past, it's like, so you've spent already 30 years with Hurdy Gurdy. You spent even longer. I would be, you know, very interested to hear on like how your relationship with books and your relationship with place have intertwined, changed over that period, that same period of time. Is kind of going off the dome here.
No, it's makes sense as a question. It's definitely intertwined. Like, I can't be in my head about literature without being in my head about place. And that's literature I'm reading, and that's stuff I'm writing. Like, I'm thinking about A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and Betty Smith's book that takes place in, you know, the early 1900s. Actually, it takes place around the 1930s, right? 1940s. But it's such a book about Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and Greenpoint at a particular time. And it tells the story of this very poor family. And in that book, I am Franny Nolan. Like I am that child. And our connection is Brooklyn. And hers was a very different time and a very different race of people. And still like that, it's the place that connects us. And then so that's Francie Nolan. And then we go to Daddy Was a Numbers Runner, which takes place, it's Louise Merriweather, which takes place in Harlem during the same period. And it's Tree Grows in Brooklyn is the white version. Daddy Was a Numbers Runner was a Black version, and that's Black poverty and place and people. And I am Franny in that book, one's Francie and one's Franny. And sometimes I confuse them. But when I reread those narratives, it is looking at people inside of place and figuring out how I can learn from that, because we can't have people without place. Like we all come from somewhere, even if we're coming from a whole lot of places, that coming from all those places is a somewhere. And so when I sit down to write, like I have to have that sense of place in my mind. And a lot of times in a lot of my books, it's Brooklyn, because the thing about Brooklyn is if I write about Park Slope 10 years from now, it's going to be a different place. Those same streets, looking at Brooklyn, looking at Bushwick, looking at Bed-Stuy, looking at Brownsville, the neighborhoods and the people change so rapidly that you are telling a different story. It's like you're writing on like a treadmill or one of those, what do they call in airports, right? You're just like going along it and you're telling the story, but if you run back to it and start again, you're gonna tell a different story.
Yeah, you talk about moving walkways, the most fun part of airports.
Thank you.
I'd be like, go on those and then turn around, go backwards, like I'm moonwalking or something.
It is so true. It was the only place I let my kids act the fool. It's like, go for it on the moving walkway. Thank you. So that's such a great question, because I think when you think of writing, we always talk about how writing is a muscle, right? And if you don't use it, it atrophies. And the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And I feel like I have so much muscle memory around people and place and story that when I sit down to write, I'm in all three of those spaces at once, where I think some writers have to kind of figure out each space. That's not the case for me. It's like, okay, here's a character, here is where they are. Now I just got to figure out why they're there and what they want and how they're going to get it. I'm seeing if I have another Brooklyn, because I want to read a little bit from that. Is that cool?
Please, please.
Okay. Yeah, of course. I never thought about that before. Like I obviously have, right? I mean, I just made that class placemaking, but like the way that she phrased it just now, like that was really putting language to something that I really felt, you know what I'm saying?
I don't have another Brooklyn, but I have read At the Bone. Another Brooklyn's in the other house. A more organized person would have brought it over. But I'm going to just read the first paragraph from Read At the Bone. So it opens with, bro, how you doing? You holding on? Man, you know how it goes. One day chicken, next day bone. Two old men talking. And it's interesting when I wrote, you know, that's what opens the book. And when I wrote that, I had originally written two old Black men talking. And I realized that to qualify them would mean that I was talking to a white audience. Right? Because in our spaces, we don't have to qualify who we are. And so I, you know, I took out that adjective. And it's interesting because it's one of the things that I talk about a lot with writers, because I don't know if it happened when you were growing up, but when I was growing up, the qualifiers always happened with the quote unquote other. Right? So a boy walked down the street, a girl walked down the street, a Black boy walked down the street. So that the narrative that you're getting is that unless otherwise specified, it's whiteness and heteronormative, right? So what I started telling students when I used to teach was like, if you're going to qualify Black folks, qualify white folks, and really figure out why what space are you in, you know, and who is this story for? And a lot of times people are not thinking about that. They're thinking about themselves as something, some part of a majority. Okay. So yeah, I'll just read that first. But that afternoon, there was an orchestra playing, music filling the brownstone, Black fingers pulling violin bows and strumming cellos, dark lips around horns, a small brown girl with pale pink nails on flute, Malcolm's younger brother, his dark skin glistening, blowing somberly into a harmonica, a broad-shouldered woman on harp. From my place on the stairs, I could see through the windows, curious white people stopping in front of the building to listen. As I descended, the music grew softer, the lyrics inside my head becoming a whisper. I knew a girl named Nikki. I guess you could say she was a sex fiend. No vocalist. The little girl didn't know the words. The broad-shouldered woman, having once belted them out loud while showering, was now saved and refused to remember them. Iris wouldn't allow them to be sung, and Malcolm's brother's sweet seven-year-old mouth was full. Still, they moved through my head as though Prince himself were beside me. I met her in a hotel lobby masturbating with a magazine. And in the room, there was the pink and the green of my grandmother's sorority, the Black and the gold of my grandfather's Alpha brothers, gray-haired and straight-backed, flashing gold cap teeth and baritone, A-fi-A, as I made my entrance. High-pitched calls of skiwi answering back to them. Another dream for me, and they're calling out to each other. Of course you're going to pledge one day, my grandmother said to me over and over again. When I was a child, she surprised me once with a gift wrap hoodie, pale pink with my grandmother as an AKA in bright green letters. That's just legacy, Melody. Look back at me on that last day in May. Has a little longer than that first paragraph. Mm.
There's something about having books read aloud to you. I was reading your book, Show Way, beautiful book about your story of your family. And that scene where Big Mama is reading around the fire, we don't have enough of that. Just being able to hear the written word just gives it a different kind of power. And like, you know, as you're reading aloud now, you know, as soon as you say Nikki was a sex fiend, I already hear the Prince song. And then you bring it up, I'm like, wow, you know what I'm saying? It like basically echoed back. But a lot of the press for Reddit though, Bone, was, you know, harking on this was a book for adults, right? And that you were like a children's book author. So is there any difference to you like writing to an adult audience versus writing to like kids? And I feel like one thing is that I would assume is like clarity. You would want, like, I guess the children's book to be simpler. Part of me also wants to assume that there's no difference at all.
It's such a great question, because it doesn't, I don't simplify it for young people unless it's, you know, like even with Shoei, when Suni's great grandmother was seven, she was sold from the Virginia land to a plantation in South Carolina without her ma or pa, with two needles her grandma had given her and thread dyed bright red with berries from the choke cherry tree. Like, I'm not downplaying enslavement or any of that. And then, you know, the scene you're talking about, at night, Big Mama read the children's story she'd tell in a whisper about children growing up and getting themselves free, and the children leaned in and listened real hard. You know, I'm talking about resistance. I'm talking about enslavement. I'm talking about the sale of Black and brown bodies. I'm talking about Reconstruction. And so, the language isn't simpler. Like that's a complicated book because you know that I'm telling the story of my family's history along the maternal line. What's different in adult books usually is it's told from the point of view of an adult, right? So it, even when you look at something like Another Brooklyn, it's the story of four 15-year-old girls, but it's told from the point of view of August, who is 30. And when you look at middle grade young adult picture books, it's usually the child's point of view. So when Suni was seven, that's all those kids are seven. Going down the line, I choose, you know, seven is the age where I start talking about their lives. When you look at something like Each Kindness, they're the person telling the story is probably around 9 years old. But even though it's a complicated story of mischances, right, of people coming to realize that tomorrow isn't promised, like, it's still a story that's told from that perspective of that 9 year old. And then when you look at something like Red at the Bone, in that scene where Melody's having her cotillion, she's 16. But it's told from so many different perspectives, and most of them are adult. There's Po' Boy, there's Sadie, there's Iris, Melody's mother, you know, there's Kathy, Marie, and Aubrey. And since most of those are adult perspectives, if everybody in this book was 16, then it would be considered a young adult book. But if they were 16, if they were 30 looking back on themselves as 16, then it's adult. So I pay attention to the language. Like when you look at something like The Other Side, which is a picture book, the opening page is, "That summer, the fence that stretched through our town seemed bigger. We lived in a yellow house on one side of it and white people lived on the other. And mama said, don't climb over that fence when you play. She said it wasn't safe." So I'm talking about segregation. I'm talking about race. I'm talking about, and I'm talking about activism, because it's about two girls who end up, you know, defying adults and saying, you know what, we're gonna do us. And still line by line. So the first line, "That summer, the fence that stretched our town seemed bigger." What it makes the person want to do is the same thing you want to do when you get to the end of a page in an adult book. That that line makes you want to go to the next line. And so here it's just spread in a book. It's just in an adult book or a book for older kids, it's spread out page by page. You want to turn the page. But when you're talking to younger kids, line by line, because they have a much shorter attention span. And that's why picture books are the hardest to write, right? Because you're dealing with a very short attention span and you're saying, I want you to sit down and read 32 pages. And I don't know, if it's whack, I'm not doing it. Like, I'm not doing it as an adult with 100 pages. So so that's it.
Wait, we didn't know you were a rapper though. Do you just like know all of your lines off the dome? Like, that's dope. That's
like so impressive. I got too much in my head. I know a lot of my books I can recite from. Yeah. I've memorized a lot of them, and I started doing it because I would go speak and I was like, I don't want to carry all these books with me. And then also the rewriting and also everything I write, I read out loud because it has to sound a certain way as well as look a certain way on the page. So yeah, I have a lot of it up here.
Yeah. I mean, what I really appreciated about you, like, you know, telling a lot of these stories is that it kind of showed me that whether it's like a picture book or a memoir form or fiction or even poetry, like when you hear it spoken aloud, it's all equally beautiful, right? And yeah, I mean, it does have me thinking, you know, what are those differences then? I guess as you've described, it is about connecting to different audiences or being able to transmit it in different ways. But, you know, I had that feeling reading Hurdy Gurdy, right? Where it's like, it feels like he's talking out loud to you, like he's just telling stories. And I got that same feeling from you right now, right? And I think maybe that's what is something that I appreciate about like all of my favorite, you know, authors and books and stories, is that they flow beautifully, like when they're spoken aloud, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you all tend to read them out loud?
No, I don't, at least.
And reading out loud, and, you know, Jen and I watched your really great TED talk too. Everyone listening to this now got to go see that, about reading slowly. And I feel like reading stuff out loud forces you to read slowly and really think about the words. And I feel like something about everything that you're saying here, you know, you talk about reading slowly, rewriting, rereading. It sounds like these things can make it a chore or like a bore, but the way you live and write and think, it seems like a delight. I'm like, man, I need to stop thinking about reading faster all the time and getting through books. I feel like a thing that I really don't like about reading and reading culture is like this want and need to say you completed a book. Like there's some like, oh, I finished it. And because you just want to say that you finished a book, you write, you just have that same urge to not even delight in it. You don't even enjoy it because you just want to be able to say it at like a dinner, at like a dinner party.
Yeah, it's so true. I remember my son in fourth grade, all the boys were carrying around these thick, you know, Harry Potter books. Ooh. And who else was it? Percy Jackson. And they were like, you know, I read 200 pages last night. And, you know, I know they were lying. But anyway, it was like this, you know, part of me was like, yay, they're doing, having this reading competition and they're saying they're reading it. But they, a lot of them weren't. And I know my son wasn't, because my son reads differently. And so, and we were reading to him, and I know how much I read to him a night. So that wasn't happening. But it was so interesting. And even with my books, because my books are short or something like Hurdy Gurdy, I just want to spend time with each poem and let it, you know, marinate and resonate. And I always say when people are like, oh, I read your book in an hour, I'm like, go back and read it again, because it took me 3 years to write that. Say that again.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked someone would even say or brag that, oh yeah, I read it in the hour.
All the time. But
oh.
But you know, I had given Ta-Nehisi Coates, we switched books, we're friends, and he had given me The Water Dancer, which is such a beautiful book. I mean, I love Between the World and Me. I love everything he writes, but The Water Dancer is some next level. And the great thing about The Water Dancer is the audiobook. It's Joe Morton reading, who I love. He just has this great voice. But we switched books, and when he got mine, he's like, oh, you trying to write one of those books, I'm not going to use the word, people are going to try to finish. He's like, you're trying to write one of those books, people are going to finish. Because like, it was so much thinner than his. And he knew that people were going to lie about his book because it was like 300 pages.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Do you read a lot of the reviews for your books? Because we've been thinking a lot about what our problem is with like book critics and book reviews. Because like a lot of them, I feel like just trying to sell books or they're just trying to say if they're good or bad. And right, they don't talk about a real texture. And also, like, I feel for a lot of the novels, all of it is always trying to talk about like a politically perfect point of view that this novel doesn't encapsulate. It's like, it can't be perfect because it's not politically like aligned with everything I believe in. And I'm like, is that what the art's for? Just to like make political statements, right? Like, no. So I'm very interested to hear your own, you know, relationship to critics and if you care for them or not.
It's so funny. It's it's nothing I can do, right? So, and this is why I don't read reviews. I mean, if I get a really good review, my editor sends it to me and says, this is a really good review, you should read it. And then I'll read it because it's just basically making me feel good. But in terms of people looking at what I didn't do in the book, there is nothing I can do about that. I'm not going to rewrite the book. It's not going to teach me anything about the next book I'm going to write, because that's a whole different story. And in terms of, you know, the politics around, you know, I always say, if I didn't do it, that opens the door for you to do it, right? So go do you. But yeah, no, I think it can be kind of, I always tell people, don't read Goodreads too, because, you know, that's everybody and their grandchild writing a review of something. But back in the day, it used to be a lot more a jury of your peers. And sometimes those peers were like ex-girlfriends. I'm like, no, they did not give my book to her to review. So it can get tricky. So no, I have a lot of self-protection around that.
Okay. That's hilarious.
That's good. I mean, nothing wrong with making yourself feel good too when it's like a nice review, you know? Like, you take the good and then like get everything else, especially when you have someone else filtering that for you. I love that.
Exactly. And we're fragile. I mean, we talk a good game, but I think so much of being a writer is about, like, you know, pulling your skin back and saying to the world, you know, look what I'm made of. And they can do, and that can be scary. So it definitely is. Mm-hmm. There are definitely steps I take to protect myself around people being mean around my work.
So you've dealt like a lot with, you know, schools and children and, you know, just through all of your books. So what is like one thing that you think, you know, most schools are doing that they shouldn't be doing, that they should stop doing to better, you know, better teach books, like have students learn and educate themselves better while reading? Because I feel like, again, growing up, you know, certain classics are, you know, shoved down your throat, you must read this. And I feel like reading, especially as a young person, you kind of come to hate it because it's this thing that you should do. It's moralized. And then, right, at school there are a ton of books you don't even want to read. So, like, what is, from all of your years, you know, dealing with education, is some big life?
That's such a great question. Yeah. It is so true. Reading as punishment is the worst thing, you know, and remember, writing as punishment when I was growing up, it's like, you're going to write an essay, and it's like, okay, way to teach me to hate writing is use it as punishment. And I do think people have to recognize that the empire is dead, like, and the canon is different. And we have to expand, we have to give young people choice. I think one thing that doesn't happen a lot is older kids aren't allowed to read picture books, you know, and there's so much to be garnered in reading picture books about how we write, about poetry, about the world, and someone getting handed War and Peace in high school who hasn't even read, you know, a chapter book is daunting and it's heartbreaking, right? And it makes a person feel lesser than that they can't be in that same space as other classmates. So I think it's really one thing I've seen done really well with one book. I know Cleveland did it and Philadelphia. They would select one book that the whole town would read, and it would be an adult book. And then they'd have the middle grade equivalent, and then they'd have the picture book equivalent. And they'd say to people, choose any of these. And it would be amazing if classrooms took that same model and said, here, look, we're going to read a book about the civil rights movement. Here's March for, you know, here's the warmth of other great migration. Here's the warmth of other suns, you know, here's Shoei, or this is the rope, which has like 25 words, and it's a story of the Great Migration, so that people can read where they are. And I think we don't stay where we are, we move from there. And I think that allowing young people to do that would make such a difference. When we talked to Jason Reynolds, you know, he talks about finishing his first book when he was in college. You know, he's a great writer now. And so this idea that you're not going to be whatever the thing is that you can be if you're not reading those quote unquote classics and at this particular age, it's a lie. So we need to shift and rethink how we think about literature and our readers, because we are going to lose them. Like, we're living in the age of TikTok and Twitter and 140 something characters. And so we're going to lose people if we don't meet them where they are and respect that.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a word that's holding us back. The canon, like, it's literally a big, heavy machine of violence. Like, if that isn't the worst image for thinking about how to like nurture like growing people, I don't know what is, right? I mean, you know, and I think what you're getting at is, because we talk about this a lot, so we're about to get really excited, but what you're getting at too is that, you know, reading books, like, you know, like many other things, but especially with books, given how intimate of a conversation it can be between yourself and, you know, who you're reading, it's really a practice in like trusting yourself, right? Because you know better than anybody your interests, you know, your energy just for like reading what you want, as well as knowing when you want to like, you know, step into something that might be a little outside of your comfort zone, right? And when you have older people who don't really see you as a person telling you that you should read this stuff for, you know, seemingly apparently, you know, abstract and completely uncalled for reasons, it's kind of like, why, right? And if you're not seen in that kind of a context, you're going to go somewhere where you are seen. But I think that that's, you know, kind of the tragedy of a lot of schooling, is that I feel like for me, reading books has been one of the few places where I have felt fully seen, and can always feel seen by the books that I read. And, you know, I guess what you're getting at is like how to make that more of an opportunity for all students, right? All children.
Oh man, you are so right. Yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to say too. And now, you know, there's that whole pushback of, because we're having such a nice flow with books that let young people be seen, that we talk about Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop, who talks about the importance of young people having both mirrors and windows in their literature, right? Mirrors so that they can see reflections of themselves, and windows so that they can see into other worlds. And for so many of the people from the global majority, we've had windows into white worlds as opposed to mirrors that reflect our own worlds. And she also talks about sliding glass doors, right? Walking into those worlds and engaging in them. And I think that as now what I'm seeing is the more and more we begin to be offered those books that offer us reflections of ourselves, you know, there's this pushback against books that talk about race. So, and under the guise of quote unquote CRT, which is ridiculous because ain't nobody in law school talking about this, right? So it's all parents who haven't read these books, but books that they're saying are making white kids feel bad because we are telling the truth about this country. So it is an interesting time when more people are reading, because they are saying, wait a second, this person is telling my story and I see myself in it. And I think the celebration of self is not going to get, it's not going to get squashed. I think we are on our way to something amazing in terms of literature and us being able to tell our stories and read our stories.
Yeah, it's honestly crazy how human beings just love to create villains out of nothing, like CRT. Like, they made it sound like a freaking disaster. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's like, what? Like, it's not that deep. I'm just trying to teach, you know, history. I, you know, just trying to tell the story how it was fully, you know, fully happened. But to ask a more fun question though, what is a question that you would want to ask another writer, either living or not with us, yeah, what question would you ask that writer and why?
I think I've been watching, you know, because I'm such a Baldwin fan, even though I know he uses a lot of adjectives and I'm a minimalist. I would want to ask James Baldwin, how do I, as a writer, continue the work he was doing as a writer and as an essayist and as a speaker? You know, every time he was so ahead of his time and was so composed and so thoughtful and so not in a hurry to explain stuff, but very intentional. And I know I'm trying to do some of it, but I would love the foresight of the ancestors in that way to know how to continue the work, because I think they can see the future in this way that can be like, okay, Jackie, in 10 years, you might want to, you know, look this way, look that way, and think about this, because here's what's changing now. You know, because we've changed so quickly in such a short amount of time. And I would love the wisdom.
All right. So this is going to sound funny too, but it's a total coincidence. But when I asked that question, when I thought of that question, the exact person I was thinking about was James Baldwin.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Because, I mean, Baldwin, I don't know. It's just the kind of writer, as soon as you get his voice in your head, it's a little haunting. Dude's writing, though, like, it slaps you in the face, not to hurt you, but to wake you up. But he also gives like the warmest hug, because it's so encompassing. It's like I wouldn't even know what to ask because it feels like he covered so much ground. Like, any quiet question that you would ask him, he already asked himself like 40 times. That was literally the exact person who I had in mind, even when I was asking that. How Bowen, in a sense, came at Richard Wright and was kind of trying to clear ground for himself as like a writer. And he wanted to critique Native Son, like the Black novel was being portrayed at that time.
Yeah. So what happened with that? Did he get canceled? Because Wright was so beloved by folks, you know, and Baldwin was so doing something so different mm-hmm. than what Wright was doing. He was not trying to create, you know, villains out of us. You know, it's so even, and also with Ellison, right? He's like invisible man, invisible to whom, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, he's not invisible. So who is this story for? And I remember hearing that, I was like,
yep.
Because right? That book was pounded on me in college. Interesting. I'm like, I don't get this. I don't get this.
Yeah, talk about a checkmate question. like you're just like, oh snap, invisible to whom? There's clearly like some of this book that's missing a huge glaring piece. And I wanted to say too that your fun facts page on your website is fucking awesome. Like, I think it's so great, and I was like, wow, we need to think more seriously about our lives and like find out what our fun facts are, you know what I'm saying? Like I think there's something so beautiful about not only knowing that for yourself, but being like proud to share it as well. And it's also like a goldmine for these, you know, more fun questions. So like, what would you say is your least favorite food? Is there a food that you just really hate more than the rest?
I know I'll get my black card taken away, but I can't stand okra.
Oh,
I know. I'm sorry.
Not even fried?
No, and everyone says you haven't had it fried. You haven't had my okra. You haven't had it in my gumbo. It's like, no, I've tried it. No, they didn't soak it well, because then it won't be snotty and such. I'm like, oh, no.
It's a weird soak food. It's kind of like, it kind of tastes like you would think like hay. Looks like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, The horse chewing.
It's so funny because there's some pickled okra in our fridge now, and it's been there for a minute, and I've tried to get rid of it. And, you know, my daughter's like, well, won't you put it out for when we have appetizers? Like, no one's going to eat it. Like, nobody likes okra in this house. Like, why is it taking up real estate in our fridge? So it's interesting. I mean, I have a long list, and it is a textural thing, but I have a long list. When people invite me to dinner, I'm just like, don't even ask. Like, here's what I'm allergic to. I'm allergic to melon, I'm allergic to avocado, and I'm allergic to eggplant. Everything else I'll eat around it. So
yeah, see, that's the thing. That's the thing in our family is that like everybody like loves avocado except for me. And it's like it's like an annual tradition where somebody's like, oh, this avocado, this guacamole is so good, Jen. You gotta keep going. I'm like, no, like we've been over this a million times.
That's funny.
Every week. Yeah. What about some of these bad 70s songs?
I have so many in my head. And it's so funny because I was thinking of the one, you know, how much love do you need before you give your love to me? How much time before it goes? How much love I want to know? And I'm like, why is that song in my head? You know, take it to the limit. Most of them are, you know, white people, because they're not a whole lot of bad black songs from the 70s, you know.
what is your go-to karaoke pick if you have?
if I could sing? I think if I could sing, it would probably be Back Down Memory Lane. You know, I can't sing. So I know.
She's hitting them dog notes though. No,
she's like breaking glass up in that song.
Yeah, exactly.
So that would be Reach for the Stars. I think Chelsea Morning, Joni Mitchell's Chelsea Morning would be like more attainable, but still not attainable. So, and I don't even have an attainable because I really can't sing. So maybe Teddy Pendergrass because he's just talking.
I actually was at a karaoke bar like last week, and that's why I asked. And there was
in Oxford.
Yes,
there was an older black man that went up and started singing "Turn Off the Lights" by Teddy, and it was priceless. Like, he shut the club down. If I'm being real, like, it was
all
the like ad-libs and just like.
Right, just like turn them off. Mom sent me the video immediately. I was like, oh.
That must have been so surreal.
It really was.
Wow.
No, I was just out on the waterfront, and this older black man was out with this big ass speaker, and you know, like the sun is setting, and he just starts playing, like he's playing like some, like, you know, like pop songs or whatever. And then the sun, right as it's going down, you just hear like the intro to A Change Is Gonna Come. And
then, oh, wow.
I was with my sister, and you're like, is he about to do this? Like, is he really about to do this? And he hit that shit. And like everybody's like around in the park listening, like, you know, people start clapping when he finishes. Somebody says encore, it's my birthday. He plays the song again. I was like,
oh man,
this is another level. Bold right here. I was like, I need to get to this level.
I love the bringing your own speaker thing, though.
Radio Ron.
Raheem. I got him right there. Hold on. Can you see him?
Oh, snap.
Wow. What a move.
What is
something that just excites you about the world now?
I have to say, young people, I can't say it enough. They are taking no prisoners. I mean, everything from don't let me mess up somebody's pronoun. And it can be like the most conservative, you know, church going or right wing kid. And they're like, they're a they. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you know, to you know, kids saying, to young people saying, I'm not going to leave this world. Y'all left us to my grandchildren. Yeah. And, you know, the hope that they have, that they'll have grandchildren, you know, to the fact that they believe deeply that they can fix this, to the fact that they're fixing it. And it, like, it just blows my mind. I remember, you know, the reason when my daughter was choosing a college, she only applied to Spelman and Howard because she grew up in New York and she went to PWIs all her life, right? And she went to a public school all her life, but she went to, New York has the highest rate of segregated schools in the country. So, you know, if you were going to go to a decent school, it was going to be predominantly white. And she's like, I'm not doing this. I did it for 12 years. I'm going to an HBCU. But before she left their school, like they organized a walkout around the segregated schools. And then they, you know, around climate change, and these kids poured out of the windows from all over the country. And I, you know, I just love the fact that I was wrong. I was wrong about social media, right? Like, I was like, you're on your phone. That's a waste of time. That's dumb. And then it's like, look what we just did. Look how we rocked the vote with social media. Look how we organized these walkouts with social media. You know, look how we're changing the world. And so I just feel like, I think that the reason that it makes me so excited is that selfishly, I'm like, we're going to be okay. You know, that you guys are doing this stuff, that it's going to be okay. And that, I think that there was a time when I thought young people were kind of just not engaged in this way, and almost like depressed, right? And repressed. And it's like, no, they were doing things. They were, wasn't stuff that I could understand or see, but it was happening. So then when big things started happening, I'm like, okay, I see y'all. So I think that when I look to where my hope is, that's where it is. Because I just got an email from someone in Ohio for an award ceremony, and they're like, well, the ceremony is going to be in person, we're going to ask people to wear masks, but we're not going to require it. I'm like, what fresh hell is this? What about the Delta variant do people not understand? Like, what about wearing masks do people not understand that it's protecting all of us, right? And so that, and I'm like, okay, that's grown-ups, like, that's a language I'm not speaking right now. but it is so interesting to watch this divide, you know, and be on the wrong side of it, right? But also be able to bear witness to the right side.
Wait, what county is that award happening in?
It's in Columbus. It's in my hometown.
The county.
I know. I wrote back. I'm like, okay, I'm going to be there, but I'm going to be masked up with my glasses on, and I ain't hugging nobody. So I just want y'all to know, and I'm putting that out there right now, but it's bananas. It makes no sense. And they're like, we're going to be so. And then I, you know, I was asked to speak in Indiana, and I, and they're like, well, there's going to be a mingle before the talk. And I'm like, who's mingling? We are in a pandemic. But it's just this kind of like, what is going on with the denial? And I understand wanting things to be the way they were, but they ain't. Yeah, it's crazy.
I know. I mean, I have no idea. Like, folks will literally be doing studies for years, though, on the effect of this pandemic on us, just mental health wise. Like, just being here in college still, and like seeing all of my classmates, like, everyone has really been impacted in different ways, to where even talking to folks now just feels different. There is just a real weight. So yeah, it will be interesting just to see in the years to come what this has really done. And right, there are just so many culture wars now. It feels like over everything, like mask wearing, vaccine, of course. Like, yeah, it's just a wild time.
What are you guys excited about?
Yeah, Jen and I, no, I'll speak for myself first. So with reading particularly, right, and this is why I asked you this, like, we are so, so excited about this project that we're doing here, Real Ballers Read, because we want to make reading just, like, as natural and fun as, like, listening to music is. Because, right, we really just feel like, again, like, reading is kind of ruined in a lot of ways by school, making it into this thing that you, again, should do and not want to do and really just enjoy. Like why not be entertained by stuff that we also feel, you know, educated by? And I'm really excited about just seeing where it goes, seeing if the message does resonate with folks still. And it's really, I don't know. I'm so pumped about it and just ready to get out of college and dedicate a lot more time to it. So
it's but that's so a very great.
Small corner of the world. Yeah. And yeah, I feel like too, in the past couple of years, I've gone from being really, really cynical about everything to just wanting to think about the things that I can control and impact and stuff that I care about. Because at the end of the day, I was just, you know, kind of feeling sad. I'm like, you know what? We at least can try, you know? We at least can even try. So that's where the room for hope is. And I'm very excited now for a lot. Yeah.
And, you know, kind of like tailing into what Miles was saying, we were wrong about social media too, partly, right? Because we went through several years, like I went through 3 years of college and like deleted all of my social media. I hated it. I hated how I felt worse every time that I got off of it. And you know, I definitely did need that cocoon, right? That self-protective like space where I could really just, you know, develop my sense of like interior self and whatnot. But you know, as Miles and I got more excited about like Real Ballers Read and really like expressing ourselves, sticking our necks out there and just connecting with more people, it became clear that, you know, social media is like one way of doing that, especially when we were in this pandemic and it's like, you know, you don't really have many other options. And so I think, you know, I'm generally excited for just, you know, that sense of like connection with more people. And we've always gotten that through books. But the more that we like, the more people that we talk to through this podcast or just like, you know, I'll randomly run into somebody who I like kind of knew and then we hit it off. And I live for moments like that where you're able to see that, you know, that whole time that I thought I was alone, like I really wasn't, you know. And I think that's those are always healing moments for me. And I'm really excited for them and like expanding them and sharing them with more people. Cause you know, we're not out of the woods. Like shit's about to get hard. Shit's about to get weird. But I would say that with every struggle so far, you know, I honestly do take it as like a sign of health. You know, when I am feeling sad or overwhelmed and, you know, hurt, because it shows that I still have feelings, right? And I know that things are not supposed to be this way. And like, we don't have to let them continue to be this way. And so when I like really stick with that truth and, you know, like have it affirmed by like other people my age or older or younger, like it's just a beautiful thing. And so Yeah, I guess just coming out of college, we're both at this point of just being excited about our lives and this unfolding and this growing.
That's so awesome. You know, my better half is a physician, and she says when, you know, patients come in and they're like, I'm fine. She's like, okay, what is going on? It's like in this moment, if people are not up in their feelings, like then something is wrong with them. You know, if we're not feeling sad and like kind of struggling in this moment, then we need to look a little deeper.
Right. I mean, because I think that was one of the first lessons learned of this pandemic for me. I mean, first of all, that I'm like incredibly grateful for like family and, you know, having a relatively safe environment. But second was that, like, I'm not okay if, like, society is not okay, right? Like, no individual is okay and fine when the community isn't. And I think I always knew that, but this, like, it really came to the fore, you know, just in this last year. And so understanding that, being more comfortable sharing my own, you know, like, my own, you know, just living with depression sometimes, it's like, you know, it just makes it a lot easier to actually connect and heal as a community when you recognize that this is a communal process, right? And I think that's where stories and books come in again, because that's how we communicate with each other, you know.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Book That Blank podcast. You can find Jacqueline Woodson's books any place books are sold, but I've heard that the reading experience is even better when you buy them from a local bookstore or check them out at your local library. Leave a review of the podcast if you enjoyed the show, and as always, catch you next time.